This is WBCR LP Great Barrington. Hello, and welcome to the Audiobook Review. I'm your host, Jason Brown. For the next couple of programs, I'm going to focus on Edith Wharton's audio recordings. They are quite extensive. Most everything of Edith Wharton's has been recorded, and very well so. BMA Studios, the company that I work with, will not be doing much Edith Wharton. Henry James, on the other hand, there's a lot of room left there, and we have recorded a couple of Henry James, and it's very difficult to record, and I think that's why it hasn't been recorded. Edith Wharton's writing, although very complicated and sophisticated, is easier to read. Henry James criticized her for that, for being simple, and she's not simple. She's been referred to as the female Henry James, and she is. They were both good friends. Henry James would stay with Edith Wharton at the Mount over here in Lenox, and they would read through the night, evidently. Balzac, Flaubert, Brontes, Keats. Now that would have been a great audio recording right there. Edith Wharton and Henry James exchanging reads. But we do have some great recordings here, and what I'm going to play you now is Derek Jacobi's rendition of a short work of Edith Wharton's called False Dawn. It's a great story, essentially. I don't mind giving the plot away. A son squanders his inheritance on European art that nobody understands. It's outrageous, and he dies in poverty. And, of course, 40 years later, the art is discovered to be priceless. It's a great story, very ironic. And I'm going to play around 6 minutes of Derek Jacobi reading. He's a wonderful reader. Of course, he's made 57 movies. And quite a few audio recordings, and perfect for Edith Wharton. This was produced by Audio Partners Publishing Corporation. Now, Edith Wharton's house, of course, is over there in Lenox, and it's beautiful to see. She wrote House of Mirth there, I believe, and Ethan Frome. Not this short story. To give you a little background about Edith Wharton, this according to Blackstone. Edith Wharton, born in 1862, died 1937, was born in New York, and is best known for her stories of life among the upper-class society to which she was born. She was educated privately at home and in Europe. She married in 1885 and was divorced in 1912. In 1894, she began writing fiction, and her novel, The House of Mirth, 1905, established her as a leading writer. Her novels, The Age of Innocence, 1920, and Old New York, from which this story is from, 1924, were each awarded the Pulitzer Prize. And she was the first woman to receive that honor. Now, I didn't know that. So, here is Derek Jacobi reading Edith Wharton's A False Dawn.
Part 1. Chapter 1. Hay, verbena, and mignonette scented the languid July day. Large strawberries, crimsoning through sprigs of mint, floated in a bowl of pale yellow cup on the veranda table. An old Georgian bowl, with complex reflections on polygonal flanks, engraved with the racy arms between lions' heads. Now and again the gentlemen, warned by a menacing hum, slapped their cheeks, their brows, or their bald crowns. But they did so as furtively as possible, for Mr. Holston Racy, on whose veranda they sat, would not admit that there were mosquitoes at High Point. The strawberries came from Mr. Racy's kitchen garden. The Georgian bowl came from his great-grandfather, father of the signer. The veranda was that of his country house, which stood on a height above the sound, at a convenient driving distance from his townhouse in Canal Street.
"Another glass, Commodore," said Mr. Racy,
shaking out a cambric handkerchief the size of a tablecloth, and applying a corner of it to his steaming brow. Mr. Jameson Ledgely smiled and took another glass. He was known as the Commodore among his intimates because of having been in the Navy in his youth, and having taken part as a midshipman under Admiral Porter in the War of 1812. This jolly, sunburnt bachelor, whose face resembled that of one of the bronze idols he might have brought back with him, had kept his naval air, though long retired from the service, and his white duck trousers, his gold-braided cap, and shining teeth still made him look as if he might be in command of a frigate. Instead of that, he had just sailed over a party of friends from his own place on the Long Island shore, and his trim white sloop was now lying in the bay below the point. The Holston Racy house overlooked a lawn sloping to the sound. The lawn was Mr. Racy's pride. It was mown with a scythe once a fortnight, and rolled in the spring by an old white horse, specially shod for the purpose. Below the veranda, the turf was broken by three rounds of rose geranium, heliotrope, and Bengal roses, which Mrs. Racy tended in gauntlet gloves under a small hinged sunshade that folded back on its carved ivory handle. The house, remodeled and enlarged by Mr. Racy on his marriage, had played a part in the Revolutionary War as the settler's cottage where Benedict Arnold had had his headquarters. A contemporary print of it hung in Mr. Racy's study, but no one could have detected the humble outline of the old house in the majestic stone-coloured dwelling built of tongued and grooved boards, with an angled tower, tall, narrow windows, and a veranda on chamfered posts that figured so confidently as a Tuscan villa in Downing's Landscape Gardening in America. There was the same difference between the rude lithograph of the earlier house and the fine steel engraving of its successor, with a specimen weeping beech on the lawn, as between the buildings themselves. Mr. Racy had reason to think well of his architect. He thought well of most things related to himself by ties of blood or interest. No one had ever been quite sure that he made Mrs. Racy happy, but he was known to have the highest opinion of her. So it was with his daughters, Sarah Ann and Mary Adeline, fresher replicas of the lymphatic Mrs. Racy. No one would have sworn that they were quite at ease with their genial parent, yet everyone knew how loud he was in their praises. But the most remarkable object within the range of Mr. Racy's self-approval was his son, Lewis. And yet, as Jameson Ledgely, who was given to speaking his mind, had once observed, you wouldn't have supposed young Lewis was exactly the kind of craft Holston would have turned out if he'd had the designing of his son and heir. Mr. Racy was a monumental man. His extent in height, width, and thickness was so nearly the same that whichever way he was turned, one had an almost equally broad view of him. And every inch of that mighty circumference was so exquisitely cared for that to a farmer's eye he might have suggested a great agricultural estate of which not an acre is untilled. Even his baldness, which was in proportion to the rest, looked as if it received a special daily polish. And on a hot day his whole person was like some wonderful example of the costliest irrigation. There was so much of him, and he had so many planes, that it was fascinating to watch each runnel of moisture follow its own particular watershed. Even on his large, fresh-looking hands, the drops divided, trickling in different ways from the ridges of the fingers. And as for his forehead and temples, and the raised cushion of cheek beneath each of his lower lids, every one of these slopes had its own particular stream, its hollow pools and sudden cataracts. And the sight was never unpleasant, because his whole vast bubbling surface was of such a clean and hearty pink, and the exuding moisture so perceptibly flavoured with expensive eau de cologne and the best French soap.
I love the way Derek Jacobi plays with the words, as Edith Wharton does, and, you know, it's like a master violinist playing Bach or Beethoven violin sonata. And the whole collection is really a lot of fun. Next up is narrator Anna Fields reading Glimpses of the Moon. This is a delightful tale. It starts off in Venice, and it's really lovely. Venice was a favorite locale for Henry James as well. This, according to the jacket of the Blackstone label, set in New York in 1920s, The Glimpses of the Moon details the romantic misadventures of Nick Lansing and Susie Branch. two high society hangers-on, with the right connections, but a lack of funds to maintain their status. They decide to marry and spend a year or so sponging off their wealthy friends, honeymooning in their mansions and villas. Both agree that if either one of them meets someone who can advance them socially, they're each free to dissolve the marriage. How their scheme unfolds is a comedy of eros that will charm all fans of Warden's work. Time for a public service announcement. I love these PSAs. They're for the public libraries. They are trying to get people to listen to books. This is Brad Meltzer. Some of you might know him. He wrote The Book of Lies recently, The Book of Fate, The Zero Game, The Millionaires, and he's written for Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He's fantasy-oriented. Wonderful writer. And these PSAs are all about getting celebrity writers and performers to endorse audiobooks. That's why I have them on this show. Here's Brad Meltzer.
Hi, this is Brad Meltzer. Nothing's more inspiring than getting lost in a story that lets my ears turn the pages. Get caught with the rhythm of a good audiobook. If I could create my own audiobook, it'd be To Kill a Mockingbird, and I'd have it read by James Earl Jones, so it'd sound like this.
So it took an 8-year-old child to bring them to their senses. That proves something.
And then at the end it would go,
I am your father.
I'm always getting caught listening to my favorite audiobook on a plane when I steal peanuts from the cart when the flight attendants aren't looking. What I'm most likely to get caught doing while getting caught listening is enjoying myself, plain and simple. I find audiobooks whenever I'm in my father's car. I steal them from him. He has no idea. Please do not tell him. This is Brad Meltzer. Hear me now. A good audiobook speaks for itself.
Get caught listening.
That may have been the funniest Darth Vader imitation I've heard. Certainly not the best. You don't hear many these days. It's a little dated. I'm not sure when this PSA was recorded. But it worked for me. But back to our audiobook. The narrator of this short tale is Anna Fields. Now, Anna Fields has recorded a lot of Edith Wharton, and I think something over 100 audiobooks. She's a pro. She actually started off as an engineer. And after the sessions, she would practice for hours. And I think she logged in something like 80 hours of practice before she cut her first audiobook. She's not with us anymore. It's well known in the inner circles, inner audio circles, that is, that she died a hero's death in her studio. There was a flash flood in Seattle, and she couldn't get out of the studio. Amazing, isn't it? It really was like the captain going down with the ship there. But I'll read you the bio on the back of this CD jacket. Anna Fields, 1965 to 2006, was one of the most respected narrators in the industry, winner of more than a dozen Earphone Awards, and the prestigious Audie Award in 2004. Trained at the Actors Theater of Louisville, she was also a director, producer, and technician of her own studio, Cedar House Audio. This is Anna Fields, also known as Kate Fleming, reading Edith Wharton's Glimpses of the Moon, and I will play a 10-minute excerpt.
Blackstone Audiobooks presents The Glimpses of the Moon by Edith Wharton. Part 1, Chapter 1. It rose for them, their honeymoon, over the waters of a lake so famed as the scene of romantic raptures that they were rather proud of not having been afraid to choose it as the setting of their own. It required a total lack of humor, or as great a gift for it as ours, to risk the experiment. Susie Lansing opined, as they hung over the inevitable marble balustrade and watched their tutelary orb roll its magic carpet across the waters to their feet. Yes, or the loan of Strefford's villa, her husband emended, glancing upward through the branches at a long, low patch of paleness, to which the moonlight was beginning to give the form of a white house front. Oh, come. When we'd five to choose from? At least if you count the Chicago flat.
So we had. You wonder.
He laid his hand on.
She sighed out a blissful assent.
And I must say that Streffy has done things to a turn. Even the cigars. Who do you suppose gave him those cigars?
She added thoughtfully,
You'll miss them when we have to go.
Oh, I say, don't let's talk tonight about going. Aren't we outside of time and space? Smell that guinea of bottled stuff over there. What is it? Stephanotis?
Yes, I suppose so. Or gardenias. Oh, the fireflies. Look! There, against that splash of moonlight on the water. Apples of silver in a network of gold.
They leaned together, one flesh from shoulder to fingertips, their eyes held by the snared glitter of the ripples. I could bear, Lansing remarked, even a nightingale at this moment.
A faint gurgle shook the magnolias behind them, and a long liquid whisper answered it from the thicket of laurel above their heads.
It's a little late in the year for them. They're ending just as we begin.
Susie laughed. I hope when our turn comes we shall say goodbye to each other as sweetly.
It was in her husband's mind to answer, they're not saying goodbye, but only settling down to family cares. But as this did not happen to be in his plan or in Susie's, he merely echoed her laugh and pressed her closer. The spring night drew them into its deepening embrace. The ripples of the lake had gradually widened and faded into a silken smoothness, and high above the mountains the moon was turning from gold to white in a sky powdered with vanishing stars. Across the lake the lights of a little town went out one after another, and the distant shore became a floating blackness. A breeze that rose and sank brushed their faces with the scents of the garden. Once it blew out over the water a great white moth like a drifting magnolia petal. The nightingales had paused, and the trickle of the fountain behind the house grew suddenly insistent. When Susie spoke, it was in a voice languid with visions.
I've been thinking, she said, that we ought to be able to make it last at least a year longer.
Her husband received the remark without any sign of surprise or disapprobation. His answer showed that he not only understood her, but had been inwardly following the same train of thought.
You mean, he inquired after a pause, without counting your grandmother's pearls?
Yes, without the pearls.
He pondered a while and then rejoined in a tender whisper.
Tell me again just how.
Let's sit down, then. No, I like the cushions best.
He stretched himself in a long willow chair, and she curled up on a heap of boat cushions and leaned her head against his knee. Just above her, when she lifted her lids, she saw bits of moon-flooded sky, encrusted like silver in a sharp black patterning of plane boughs. All about them breathed of peace and beauty and stability, and her happiness was so acute that it was almost a relief to remember the stormy background of bills and borrowing against which its frail structure had been reared.
People with a balance can't be as happy as all this, Susie mused, letting the moonlight filter through her lazy lashes.
People with a balance had always been Susie Branch's bugbear. They were still, and more dangerously, to be Susie Lansing's. She detested them. Detested them doubly, as the natural enemies of mankind, and as the people one always had to put oneself out for. The greater part of her life had been passed among them. She knew nearly all that there was to know about them, and judged them with the contemptuous lucidity of nearly 20 years of dependence. But at the present moment her animosity was diminished not only by the softening effect of love, but by the fact that she had got out of those very people more, yes, ever so much more, than she and Nick, in their hours of most reckless planning, had ever dared to hope for.
After all, we owe them this, she mused. Her husband, lost in the drowsy beatitude of the hour, had not repeated his question, but she was still on the trail of the thought he had started. A year. Yes, she was sure now that with a little management they could have a whole year of it. It was their marriage, their being together, and away from bores and bothers. In a comradeship of which both of them had long ago guessed the immediate pleasure, but she at least had never imagined the deeper harmony. It was at one of their earliest meetings, at one of the heterogeneous dinners that the Fred Gillows tried to think literary, that the young man who chanced to sit next to her, and of whom it was vaguely rumored that he had written, had presented himself to her imagination as the sort of luxury to which Susie Branch, heiress, might conceivably have treated herself as a crowning folly. Susie Branch Pauper was fond of picturing how this fancied double would employ her millions. It was one of her chief grievances against her rich friends that they disposed of theirs so unimaginatively. I'd rather have a husband like that than a steam yacht, she had thought at the end of her talk with the young man who had written, and as to whom it had at once been clear to her that nothing his pen had produced or might hereafter set down would put him in a position to offer his wife anything more costly than a rowboat. His wife! As if he could ever have one, for he's not the kind to marry for a yacht either. In spite of her past, Susie had preserved enough inner independence to detect the latent signs of it in others, and also to ascribe it impulsively to those of the opposite sex who happened to interest her. She had a natural contempt for people who gloried in what they need only have endured. She herself meant eventually to marry, because one couldn't forever hang on to rich people. But she was going to wait till she found someone who combined the maximum of wealth with at least a minimum of companionableness.
Anna Fields has a very strong, centered, and focused delivery. It's great for an audio narrator. You stay with her. She likes the audience. You just got the feeling that she's a very nice person. Also, very intelligent. She knows exactly what she's talking about. Anna Fields has also read Edith Wharton's biography by Cynthia Griffin Wolfe. It's a rich, rich text. Not only does it wonderfully depict Edith Wharton's life, but has deep insights into her own work. And you wonder if Edith Wharton had those insights herself, or it's just unconscious, but Cynthia Wolfe goes really deep with this. And it's very good writing, and I'm going to play some of that on the next program. When I listened to it, my IQ went up like 50 points after the first tape. It felt very good. That concludes this program. I'll be playing more Edith Wharton, like I said, on the next one. I'm your host, Jason Brown. This has been the Audiobook Review, and look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you for joining us.